All right, folks, we're ready to tackle our last chapter on stocks, Chapter 8, Behavioral Finance and the Psychology of Investing. And we can sum up the entire chapter in a quote by Mr. Benjamin Graham. Remember, you're going to read The Intelligent Investor eventually, right? Yes, you are. The investor's chief problem, and even his or her worst enemy, is most likely to be himself or herself. So I've made it a little bit more PC. When he wrote it, he just used him and himself. Yeah. Yeah, you are your own worst enemy when you were investing. Or as we've quoted Warren Buffett, investing is simple, but it ain't easy. So let's take a look at behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. Slide number one. Investor what? Psychology, the study of psychos. I prefer to call it slycology. Like that one? Slycology? I used slycology on them. In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asks, "So, when is the stock market going to recover?" The advisor curtly responded, I am an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist. Yeah. Slide number three. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investor psychology. And some of the research is very revealing about who and what we are, not only as investors, but also as a species in general. There's an old Wall Street saying, there are three factors that influence the markets. Fear, greed, and greed. Yeah. Greed usually wins out. Right now, who knows? You know, there's a lot of fear out there, but there's also still a lot of greed, but pretty soon, I think the greed is going to win, and we're going to be... Anyway, slide number four. Excuse me. Common investor weaknesses. Reading too much into the recent past. Beware the permanent trend. Huh? Permanent trend? That's an oxymoron. That's Andrew Tobias who said beware the permanent trend. Markets move in cycles. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon, just as the bandwagon was about to veer into a ravine, we trick ourselves into believing that it's different this time. It's a new era. Or if you hear people say, is it too late to get in? That's usually a sign it's too late to get in. If they're saying, is it too late to get out? It's usually a sign, yeah, it's too late to get out. So are you piling into gold and treasury bonds now? Did you buy oil in mid-2008 when it hit $147 a barrel, only to fall to $39 a barrel within, 6 to 8 months? Now it's up to 90 or so a barrel. How did that condo conversion flipper in early 2006 work out? Oh, not so good, huh? Sorry. What about eToys or the Globe or CMGI in 1990, you don't even know what those companies are, do you? But they were all the rage when the internet bubble was inflating. Yeah, exactly. As we talked about, you know, people tend to jump around everybody's running in one direction, they run in that direction. Everybody's running the other direction, they follow them. So beware the permanent trend. Misperceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, our brains will trick us into seeing a pattern. Why? Because we humans are heuristic. We look for patterns. Even if we know beforehand that there aren't any patterns to be found. Even if we're told, you know, this is not random, this is random. There's no pattern to it. We try to superimpose a pattern on top of it because that's just the way our brains are wired. For example, in a series of a million random digits, you know, zeros through nine a million times, the probability that one of those digits, zero through nine, will be repeated 13 times in a row is essentially 100%. Yeah, if you have a million random digits, if you don't see 13 sevens or 13 threes, it doesn't matter which number, it just has to be one number that's repeated 13 times, then you know it's not random. Right, somebody's fudged it. In my humble opinion, technical analysts are guilty of this failing. They superimpose patterns on short-term randomness, even though the statistics have shown that, you know, there's no pattern to be found. And we'll discuss technical analysis in this chapter. Slide number 6, being overconfident. Believing you know more than you think you know, or believing that you are better than most other investors. The truth is, folks, that we individual investors only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what is happening within a company, an industry, and the economy. Think about the mutual fund companies and other management companies. They have investment professionals all around the world, and it's hard for them to do well. We're sitting here in front of a terminal, in front of a computer, thinking that we can, you know, yeah, right. And we are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we decide to become traders and think we're going to, you know, hit the fastball at 98 miles an hour. And how can we relate this phenomenon? Well, if you ask a group of 100 people, are you an excellent, good, average, fair, or poor driver? Fully 80% of them will normally say they are either excellent or good. A few, you know, will say they're average, and virtually no one says they're a fair or poor driver. Everybody's above average. And there's a name for this. It's called the Lake Wobegon effect. And you probably never listened to Garrison Keillor and his news from Lake Wobegon. But if you ever do, that's his tagline. He says that's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. Wait a minute, they can't all be above average because then there's no. Hey, well that's the same thing. We think we're all above average, and it turns out that, you know, we're probably not even average. We're probably fair or poor when it comes to investing. Especially if we think we're going to be a hotshot trader. Slide number 7, selling your winners too soon and hanging on to your losers. It's called loss aversion. And we mentioned this in the previous chapter briefly. As humans, we hate to admit we made a mistake. So we stubbornly hold on to our losers, hoping that they will at least get back to where we bought in. So we bought it at 10, it's now selling at 3, and we're going to hang on to that puppy until it goes back to 10. Well, as we said in the previous presentation, if you wouldn't buy it now at $3, it's not a good investment. It's time to take your losses and move on. The reality is that our memories are wired to quickly forget unpleasant experiences. That's the way we're wired. Sell our losers, and you will quickly forget about them. You'll go on to the next investment. Hang on to them, hoping beyond hope that they're going to come back to where you bought in so you could sell and say that you didn't have a loss. And you will always be reminded of your stupidity. Every time you look at the screen or look at your statement and say, oh yeah, I still own bananasrus.com or whatever it is. In contrast, folks, hanging on to the winners is what makes an investor rich. So once you've found a good company that has good long-term perspectives, you want to hold on to it. As Mr. Bogle says, you hold it forever. Or Mr. Buffett, you hold on to it and you enjoy the fruits of the company's labors and successes. And that doesn't mean you stubbornly hold on to it, but you know, we talked about the 3 to 5 year. You go back to chapter 6 and all that stuff. Peter Lynch. Peter Lynch was once asked what the worst mistake, investing mistake he ever made in his life. And he's got a dry sense of humor. He said, I bought Home Depot when it you know, first started out, and I made 100% profit. I doubled my money, and I sold it. And people look at him and say, that's the worst mistake you ever made? He said, yeah, it then went up 20 more times. Exactly. Right, he didn't hold on to his winners. Okay, slide number 8. Fundamental analysis review. Here's chapter 6, right? The in-depth study of the financial condition and operating results of a firm. A method of evaluating securities by attempting to measure the intrinsic value of a particular stock. Fundamental analysts study everything from the overall economy and industry conditions to the financial condition and management of companies. Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock, right? And we say we're interested in future earnings, growth of future earnings, and future dividends for some companies. Other companies are, you know, no dividends because they're growth companies. But still, we're looking at the future, we're looking at the company, and the valuation models from Chapter 6 that we covered have all used fundamental analysis. Some of the fundamentals on slide 9 to review, the competitive position of the company. Don't forget to look at the REITs. They're competitors. You research one company, you can't research it in a vacuum. Its composition, its growth in sales and earnings, profit margins, dynamics of company earnings, the composition and liquidity of corporate resources, what assets are available, how much debt, how much equity, what's called the capitalization of a company, and all the other ratios that we computed in Chapter 17. We look at all those as a stew and say, you know, what's going on. But there are many investors who don't follow the fundamentals. They say, poo, 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 we're not interested in that. They are technical analysts. Slide number 10. Technical analysis is the study of the various forces at work in the marketplace and their effect on stock prices. Those who adhere to technical analysis believe that they can predict the future price of a stock by analyzing the behavior of the stock price's history and or the overall stock market, and they use any one or many of dozens of so-called technical indicators. Simply put, the future price of a stock is influenced by factors other than the company's fundamental future outlook. So a pure technical analyst would say, I don't care about the company itself. I just want to see what's going on with the price of the stock. And I want to be able to predict the future given the price of the stock. Now, obviously, there's a spectrum, isn't there? There are people like me who just don't put any credence whatsoever in technical analysis, and there are other people who don't put any credence whatsoever in fundamental analysis, and then there are people in the middle who use a little bit of both or maybe a lot of both, and so I'm not trying to say it's an either or proposition. It's just what it is. It's looking at certain items that have been affected by the price of the stock and the volume and all the other things, and saying, ooh, I think it's going to go up, or ooh, I think it's going to go down. Slide number 11. Argument in favor of technical analysis. Stock prices do tend to move in tandem to the stock market as a whole. When the stock market as a whole is rising, well, most stocks rise with it. There's a saying called a rising tide lifts all boats. And when the market is falling, most stocks are brought down with it. Well, that's just supply and demand at work. And as we'll see, we're going to do bonds next, but then we're going to get to asset allocation, and we'll see how correlation gets involved. It's just when stocks are in favor, prices rise, and when stocks are out of favor, prices fall. But using the fact that the market has gone up for the last 2 years, and then extrapolating that it's going to do that, you know, this year, there's no statistical basis for that. And so repeat after me at the bottom of the slide. There has never been a reliable methodology for predicting the short-term behavior of the stock market. There are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly predict the short-term behavior of the stock market. And they know that they're going to be right sometimes and wrong sometimes, and then they'll tell you why they were wrong and why they're going to be right this time, and hope that you actually believe them and pay them gobs of money. Can you imagine if they actually could predict the short-term behavior of the market? Would they bother to tell you? Would they be on CNBC? No, they wouldn't. They would be. They wouldn't be telling you if they could do it. No, nobody. At least that's what we've seen in history. The short-term behavior of the market has been shown to be random. And the one company in the 1990s that, as we said, long-term capital management, I think I already told you, they had two Nobel laureates and one... the best, but one of the best bond traders in the world, John Merriweather. Remember, we discussed him back in chapter one. And yet they failed miserably and had to have the Federal Reserve Bank come to their rescue. This was 1998. And there's a wonderful, video and a book when genius fails, and a video, The $1 trillion Bet. And you watch this thing and it's like a prequel. It's like a precursor to the housing bubble 10 years later. It's like the Hobbit to the Lord of the Rings. For those of you who've read the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, it's unbelievable. And yet there are people who are convinced that they can do it, and they'll for $3,000 they'll show you. Yeah, right. Slide number 12. Here are some of the tools of technical analysis. And folks, I'm not trying to pick on Stock Market Mentor. The guy goes on television every once in a while. And, check out his website. There are many like it. And he's going to want you to sign up for $50 or whatever it is a month. And he'll tell you why he believes it's going to go into the... there's no basis in research. And he was absolutely wrong on both counts. But maybe he's right on a few others, so check it out. The trend is your friend. Momentum buying. If stocks are going up, you buy. If they're going down, you sell. Or maybe you sell short, and we'll discuss that later on in the semester. The support level. The resistance level. The support level is the price or level below which a stock or the market as a whole is unlikely to fall. At least that's what they'll tell you. It hit 50, going down three times, and each time it went back up again. So the technical analysts call that support. And if the resistance level is going the other way, if it hit 60 three times and every time it went down, that was a resistance level. And we'll see some graphs and we'll point it out. And then psychological barriers, Dow at 13,000, 14,000, 15,000, 10,000, the S&P at 1,500, $100 for a stock. They call them psychological barriers. And for some reason, we are enamored with zeros. Whenever there's... I like it when my car goes over 99,999 into one. That's what we get enamored with it. But remember, those indices are just they're made up of 500 companies or 30 companies in the Dow or 1,000, and then moving averages. Moving averages, they just sound so tempting. It's the average price calculated using a fixed number of previous days. So it moves every day. 50-day moving average, 200-day moving average, and you go back 50 days, or you go back 200 days, or 10 or 15, depending on your choice of moving averages. And you say, ooh, it's broken out. It's time for you to buy. Well, maybe sometimes it is and sometimes it ain't. So slide number 13. Here is Starbucks and the 50-day moving average and the 200-day moving average. And this is the bonus exercise that I'm going to ask you to do. It's a bonus. You don't have to do it for Chapter 8. I'm going to ask you to pick a stock, and you can pick any stock, but I picked the one I picked for a reason. And then you can pick another one on your own. And you see the blue. Let's use the magic cursor. The blue is the stock price bouncing up and down. So what they did here is they superimposed a 50-day moving average. It's red. And it, what it does is it smooths out the stock price, see? Because it's going back 50 days and calculating the average. And then they superimposed a 200-day moving average. That's the green. And when the 50-day goes above the 200-day, that's supposedly a sign that it's time to buy. So in this case, it kind of worked out if you held on to it. See, it popped up here. The time to buy was back here. But the 50-day goes over the 200-day, and then Starbucks proceeds to go up from about, you know, 13 or so up to 20. You see? So that's supposed to be a bullish signal. And then if it goes down from above, if the 50-day were to fall below the 200-day, that's supposed to be a bearish signal, meaning that the stock is going to go down. And what you'll find is that sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not true, and it's about as true as many times as it's not true. And then there are times when it bounces back and forth across the 50-day and the 200-day, and and then they'll say, well, you need to do the 10-day and the 50-day, or somebody else will tell you to use something else. So you have to decide. But what's cool about the assignment is that you don't actually have to know what you're doing. You only have to convince yourself and me that you know what you're doing. That's the great thing about technical analysis, because nobody can disprove you wrong, nor can they prove you right. There's no scientific basis for it. Wow, what a great business if you can get the job, right? $400,000 a year plus bonuses, and all you have to do is act like you know what you're doing. Slide number 14, the Dow theory, one of the more historically popular price movement technical theories. It uses the industrial average, the Dow, and then the Dow Jones Transports average. The Dow theory tries to identify three forces: a primary direction or trend, a secondary reaction or trend, and daily fluctuations. And by watching the changes in the primary and secondary directions of the indices, you are supposed to be able to determine the overall direction of the market. I've had two people try to explain it to me. I don't understand it. Here's the graphic. And, to me, what it says is the market goes up and down. Right? I know that already. In fact, when people ask me, what's the market going to do? I say, it'll go up and down. And they go, well, I knew that. I said, what'd you ask me for? And of course, I'm stealing from the best, because once J.P. Morgan, you've heard of J.P. Morgan Chase, right? The bank and the Morgan Stanley. He was once asked, what's the market going to do, J.P.? He said, the market will fluctuate. It'll go up and down in the short term. Slide number 16, relative strength. And that was one of the value lines. They're not the only ones. Investors Business Daily, which is published in Los Angeles, they're a real big fan of the relative strength indicator, which is the measure of a performance of an investment relative to other stocks in their category or the market as a whole. But again, you're looking at the past. It's not, you know, it's not a guarantee for the future. Market volume, heavy volume, low volume. And those are the little graphs at the bottom of the graphs that you see, the little spiky things. A heavy volume with prices rising, well, that's supposed to be a good sign. And low volume with prices falling is supposed to be a good sign, because, okay, prices are falling, but with low volume, don't worry about it. Heavy volume with prices falling, well, that's bad. Everybody run for the hills. And low volume with prices rising. Well, the prices are rising, but the volume's low. Don't. It's a fake out. Slide number 17. The breadth of the market. The advanced decline. Not the breadth. Haha, that breadth. No, then. How many stocks went up? How many stocks went down? When the mood of investors is bullish, the idea is that the advanced decline ratio should rise. The number of advancing issues should outnumber the declining issues. And when the number of investors is bearish, when the mood of investors is bearish, the advance decline ratio should fall. Declining issues should outnumber advancing issues. But It's not always true. In fact, in the late 90s, the S&P 500 was going gangbusters. But more stocks were going down than were going up. What was happening, as we saw, and when we took a look at the we talked about index funds and indices and how they get skewed, a subset, the top 50 to 100 companies in the S&P 500 were just skyrocketing, but many of the old economy stocks were actually going down because people didn't want to buy real estate investment trusts or old economy stocks like railroads and food companies. How boring. You want telecom. You want internet. You want computer companies and software companies. And then the tick. I don't like ticks. Not that tick. The trade by trade direction of the market. Is it an uptick? Is the stock market going up, or is the stock going up, or is it a downtick? And what happened at the beginning? Was the opening tick positive at the beginning of the market? Did the stock jump, or did it fall? A closing tick. What was happening at the end of the market? Is it a bullish tick? You know, things are going up. Is it a bearish tick? But again, you're looking at the past, and it's no guarantee what's going to happen in the future. Plus, no statistical analysis has been able to show that by using what happened in the past, you'd be able to conduct yourself well into the future. So there you have it. And now slide 18. I keep saying I apologize, but this is what's out there, folks. And this is why we say chapters 7 and 8 have plenty of silliness. But here, slide number 18, this is actually some good stuff. So just let's look at this. Short interest. The number of stocks sold short in the market at any given time. And here's the reality. The more stocks are sold short, the more investors believe the market will fall. And we've danced around this selling short, and we'll get to it in earnest at the end of the semester, around in a while. But what I want you to understand is that when you sell short, you believe the market's going to fall, or that individual stock is going to fall. And for some reason, short investors are somehow considered more sophisticated and are therefore supposed to know when the market will fall, right? Because short investors, first of all, they understand what it means to short a stock, so obviously they must be more sophisticated than the average layperson. But I got to tell you, an investor I know, a very good friend of mine, who short stock, I didn't think he was very smart doing it. He was doing it when the housing bubble was still expanding, and he was shorting the housing builders and the lenders, and he was absolutely right, but he was 2 years too soon. He was doing it in 2005 and early 2006. He should have waited till 2007, 2008, and then he would have cleaned up. But, you know, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And so I don't necessarily agree that short investors are more sophisticated than anybody else. They're just betting that a stock will go down, and they may be right and they may be wrong. And the problem is, when you sell short, you can lose a lot of money quickly. But when large numbers of investors sell short, eventually they must buy the shares back. When you buy shares long, which is what you normally do, you buy a stock and you hold on to it, you can hold it forever. Not when you sell short. You've got to eventually buy it back. And what this does is it creates a pent-up demand. And you economic students know what happens, right? When demand goes up, so will the prices. So a large amount of short interest is like a compressed spring. Eventually, there will be a short squeeze. That's what it's called, a short squeeze, because everybody sold the stock short, and they have to turn around and buy it back. So you'll see the stock market plummet, boom, go right down. And those were all the short sellers, piling on, the momentum short sellers, pushing the prices down. And then, bingo, it'll shoot back up again. And that's why I try to get people who see the market fall precipitously in a day, say, relax, relax, and they go, 2 days later it went back up. I said, that's, you know, that's the market. You have to be prepared for that emotionally as well as intellectually. Slide number 19. As a matter, let me just one last comment on this. Short selling in August of 2002, and that was a pretty rough bear market, not as bad as 2008 and 2009, but the level of short interest on the in the New York Stock Exchange hit a halt all-time high. And for some reason I had this odd feeling of relaxation. I said, oh, okay, it's getting near the end because, you know, everybody's piling on. And I was right. It doesn't mean I'm right because I wasn't that smart, but it just I knew it was going to happen. And in October, it did. We hit the bottom in October. But we didn't actually start coming out of it until March of 2003. And the same kind of thing happens whenever there's a major downturn. Now, slide number 19, odd lot trading. Remember odd lots, right? This theory is based on the idea that small investors tend to buy and sell in odd lots. It's a less than 100 shares. And the thing to do is the opposite of what small investors are doing, the best thing to do. That's the reasoning. There's, you know, very little data and research that you can point to that says that this is true. If odd lot trading rises, it supposedly means that more and more small investors are entering the market, and small investors are supposedly notorious for getting into the market at the top of a bull market. But remember that technology has made odd lot trading commonplace. It's not that big a deal anymore. So yes, I don't put much credence, much faith in this, but it's out there, and people will tell you, oh yeah, the odd lot trading's up, markets are probably going to fall. Maybe not. Slide number 20, contrarian opinion. Well, we've already discussed contrarian opinion. The theory is that if that people are very optimistic, that is a predictor of falling prices, and if people are very pessimistic, that's a predictor of rising prices. Therefore, we should all walk around being as depressed and bearish as possible and say, oh, yeah, the market's going to fall, the market's going to fall, and that will make the market rise, right? But it is true. You go back in time, and when you see everybody in the financial media saying, yeah, the prices of stocks are going to go to the roof, they're going to go to the moon, that was usually the worst time to buy. And when you hear everybody saying, oh, it's horrible, it's terrible, that's usually a good sign to buy. Now, what do we have most of the time? We have lots of people screaming and hollering the market's going to fall. We have lots of people screaming and hollering the market's going to rise. So it sort of cancels it each other out. And we've already covered contrarian strategy. You buy when others are selling and sell when others are buying. But the problem, as we discussed, is that the market historically has gone up about 3 times more often than when it goes down. Yeah, for every 1 year it goes down, there's 2 or 3 years that it goes up. You don't know which years they're going to be. And as we saw with the serious contrarian investors, they're willing to sit on their hands and wait for a mania bubble and then sell, or wait for a crash, a market crash, and then buy. And that's their strategy. Okay. In fact, there's one strategy that says you should wait for the market to go down 2 years in a row before you invest. Well, if you did that between 1982 and 2000, you wouldn't have invested a dime in the market, in the stock market. And then you would have seen market go down in 2000 and 2001, 2 years in a row. Okay, great. It's time to get back in. In 2002, it dropped 22%. So you see there were 18 years when the market went up, and then 3 years in a row when it went down. So you just don't know what's going to happen in the short term, in the 1 to 2 or 3 years. But hopefully, if the system continues and we're all well-fed, well-clothed, and well-sheltered, over the next 10 to 15 years, we'll have about 3 up years for every 1 down year, as history has told us. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. Slide number 21, charting. Okay, this is the one type of technical analysis you're going to see people try to do and sell you and get you interested in. The activity of charting price behavior and other market information, and then using the patterns these charts form to make investment decisions. High, low, close charts, candlestick charts, chart formation. We talked about the resistance and the support levels, and then you break out of the resistance level, or you break out on the downside of the support level. The dreaded head and shoulders, triangles, flags and pennants, cups and saucers, and yeah, right. Slide number 22. Here is an open, high, low, close chart. And what it's showing you is that this was for this whatever day that is, the market price of this stock, Sun Microsystems, which has now been purchased by Oracle, went between these two highs. There was the high and there was the low, and this is what it opened at and this is what it closed at. And the reason it's red is because it closed lower than what it opened. And on this day, it closed higher than what it opened. And you're supposed to be able to say, oh, look at that. We're going to superimpose some kind of formation, some kind of a pattern on these, and be able to predict what's going to happen in the future. Well, you're also told how to use these candlestick charts. The longer the body, the more bullish or bearish the implication may be. And so, in other words, here's the high, here's the low, and if it opens lower than the close, well, then it's gray, and if it closes lower than the open, then it's black. So here are some of those patterns. Here is a dark cloud cover. See, because this day it closed higher than it opened, but this day it closed lower than it opened, a dark cloud. And then the engulfing pattern, which is supposed to be really bad. And then the harami, which I don't even, it's a Japanese term, it's really, really bad. So what is going to happen in day three? I don't know, but you're supposed to be able to figure out that day three is not going to be good from these three charts. But then, of course, you look at day three and it goes up. Figure that one out. And then here's the dreaded head and shoulders chart. Doesn't that look like a head and shoulders to you? Don't tell me, and don't ask me why, because I don't know, but supposedly this is really bad. If this happens, you should sell because it's too late. You've already lost your shirt. This was the one question on the Series 7 that I got about technical analysis. One of the very famous technical analysis charts that people use is the head and shoulders chart. Supposedly it's bad because it tried to go way up and then it didn't and now it's gone down and there's the neckline. Yeah, right. And then here's the real popular one, the resistance and support level. So here's a triple top. This stock went up, hit the resistance level, came down, hit the support level, resistance, support, and then broke out on the upside. And then this is supposed to be the head and shoulders where the breakout is on the downside, and that's bad. It looks the same as the other one, except this one breaks out on the downside. They don't show the resistance level. I mean, here's the support level, and it broke. I can't figure this stuff out. If you can, good. Teach me how to do it. Or better yet, do the optional assignment and act like you know what you're talking about, and you get 10 points. And then here's the triangles, which I guess are supposed to be bad. I don't know. Maybe they're good. And then the flag and the pennant. Flag, not so good, but pennant, oh boy, that's what you want. And all I can say is lots of luck, folks, because I think it's total borscht. But that's me. That's me, and I tell you up front what my biases are. I like to use statistics, right, statistics. And the statistics tell us that this stuff, you know, in hindsight, is worthless. And as I said, the statistics tell us that the stuff we did in Chapter 6 is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but at least it tilts the odds in your favor. It doesn't mean you're going to always make the right decision. You're not going to always make the right decision. But this is just, you know, and again, this is for short-term trading, and what do we know about short-term traders? Yeah. Slide number 27. And this takes the cake. This is from the Random Walk Down Wall Street. So again, as I said, Professor Malkiel loves to skewer everybody. He does a great job of it. And this is real, folks. This was a real report that came out from a technical analyst from Wall Street trying to tell people that he knew what he was doing, or she. The market's rise after a period of reaccumulation is a bullish sign. There, nevertheless, fulcrum characteristics are not yet clearly present, and a resistance area exists 40 points higher in the Dow. So it is clearly premature to say the next leg of the bull market is up. If, in the coming weeks, a test of the lows holds and the market breaks out of its flag, a further rise would be indicated. Should the lows be violated, a continuation of the intermediate term trend downward, is called for. In view of the current situation, it is a distinct possibility that traders will sit in the wings awaiting a clearer delineation of the trend, and the market will move in a narrow trading range. Now, did you understand what he says? I think what he's saying is if the market does not go up or down, it will remain unchanged. I think that's what he's saying. Right? The market will fluctuate. The market will go up and down, and you'll look like a genius. Slide number 28, careers in stocks. Now, hopefully, some of you have gotten really excited and say, you know what? I think I'd like to work in this industry. And there's a career for you, folks, especially as more and more people are being asked to fund their own retirements, right? The traditional defined benefit plan is disappearing, and we're being asked to do it ourselves. So they need help. And the place you usually start with is a registered representative. That's the legal term for a stockbroker, financial representative, account executive, financial planner. What they're going to do is a background check. They want to make sure that you've done no shenanigans with other people's money. You must take the Series 7 and the Series 66. Now, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. The Series 7 is very difficult. But it's not impossible. It's a six-hour test, 3 hours in the morning, and then an hour for lunch, and then 3 hours in the afternoon. And the questions start out fairly easy, and then they get really hard. In fact, they become impossible. And then they get easy again over the three-hour period. And they tell you this is going to happen. I mean, they warn you beforehand. And they tell you that some of the questions have nothing to do with what you studied, and we're just throwing them in there, and we're testing new questions, and some of them don't. And you say, thanks a lot. I'm a guinea pig? Yeah. But don't worry. If you don't get those wrong, you don't get penalized. And there are several parts to the Series 7. You have to pass each part with a 70%. So you can't blow off. You cannot ignore certain sections. And the two sections that get people the most are the options and futures, specifically the options, and the shorting and margining. And at the end of the semester, we will take a look at those two areas, those three areas, options, futures, shorting, margining. They work together. And you'll see some of the types of questions you'll get on the Series 7. And you'll see that they are pretty tricky. But if you study 2 months, an hour a day, 2 hours a day, take the practice exams, you should pass it. It's a commitment. But once you've passed it, you're in. And then you just have to do continuing education after every once in a while. The Series 66, much easier. 2 to 4 weeks of studying an hour a day, piece of cake, it's an hour exam. Must be sponsored by a brokerage firm. And what they will do now is they will hire you often as a broker's assistant, a broker's aide, and they'll check you out. And if they like you, they'll sponsor you. And it's expensive. It's an expensive test. I don't know how much it is now, but when I took it in 1998, it was $500 to take the test. Probably more expensive now. And you have to be sponsored. For many years, the brokerage firms were not sponsoring people. So some brokerage firms existed simply to sponsor people. You were expected to pay $1,000, $2,000 just for the privilege of being sponsored. Well, that's not going on anymore. The brokerage firms are sponsoring people, and some of the states, California was one of them, was really coming down on the Securities and Exchange Commission and the National Association of Securities Dealers, which is now FINRA, and they were saying, this is not right. We should not be setting up a system where people just pay to maybe be able to get a job. We don't like this. So the states were getting angry, and they were saying, well, we'll set up, they were saying, if you don't change this, we'll set up a system that allows people to become sponsored. And so the FINRA, which was NASD at the time, and the brokerage firm said, okay, we'll start sponsoring recruits. And they are. They love bilingual individuals, folks. They want more women, and they love ex-military. Why? Because it's a structured environment. It's a highly regulated environment. Folks, you are handling other people's money. You cannot be a flake. And so they like people who've been in a structured environment. And as I said, they need more bilingual. They need more women. And so think about it, folks. Think about it. And if you do are interested, bring your syllabus from Business 123 and show them what you've learned in this class. And, of course, you're going to get a good suit. You want to spiffy yourself up. Get that resume. Make sure it is spotless, not a single typographical error, and get out there, and good luck, and use me as a reference. I'd be happy. And if you are going to take the Series 7, call me. I'll do what I can to make sure you know what you're doing. But most of the brokerage firms have their own training sessions and the like. Okay, and so hopefully we'll see. I've had some people from this class go right into a broker's aide, broker's assistant, and do well, yeah. So that is it, folks. We are finished with stocks. Yeah, we've spent how many weeks on stocks, right? Like 5-6 weeks on stocks, and you need to go back and learn all this stuff, folks. Now again, chapter 7, 7 and 8 are kind of fluffy. 5, 6, and 17 are the meat. But we're done. And now we're ready to start bonds. Boring, stodgy, reliable bonds. Thank you very much for sticking with us this far. And see you in the next chapter on bonds.